I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. When I was a young boy, one of my very favorite books was by a fellow named Uncle Nick. Actually, his full name was Elijah Nichols Wilson. And the book had a title, Among the Shoshones. Now, this book was autobiography of a young boy in pioneer times. He leaves his family. He goes away to live with Native Americans. He's befriended by a Native American chief, well-known name in the Wyoming area, Idaho, northern Utah, Washakie. And this chief becomes something like an adopted brother to him. And making this story all the more fascinating, at least to me, was that his granddaughter, Reva Dalley, was a family friend and one of the kindest women I'd ever met. She was like a doting grandmother to me. And that book by her grandfather, that autobiography, it got read. Its pages were tattered. But I have to tell you that the story of this Uncle Nick is more interesting than just all of that. He also happened to be among the riders for the Pony Express. And the chilling part of the story that I remember best was that he survived being shot in the head by an arrow and left for dead. Now, that's my personal, if somewhat tenuous, connection to the Pony Express. I must confess, I know very little about the Pony Express other than what I've told you already. But that's a problem that can always be remedied here on this show. I learn a lot with help from experts like our next guest. Jim DeFelice is with us. He's written prolifically with titles of both fiction and nonfiction. He's a New York Times best-selling author. And today we're going to speak with him about his book, West Like Lightning, The Brief Legendary Ride of the Pony Express. Jim DeFelice, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You know, I'm going to mention the Alamo because the Alamo is one of those American stories about failure, and in a rather strange way, we end up celebrating the memory of it all. And I'm wondering if the Pony Express story isn't kind of like that, you know, a much heralded failure.
Well, you know, it was a failure in certain ways. The company went bankrupt. So I guess at least by that, you know, judging by that, you can't say it was a huge success. But, you know, in a larger sense, it you know, you have all of the ingredients of a huge success. And, you know, as we're talking today about, you know, something that, you know, 160 years ago still lives on in our memory. It's you know, a romantic tale, a tale of, you know, great bravery of man, and all of the riders were men, mostly young men around age 20, man against the elements and proving that things could be done, and really, you know, kind of knitting this disparate nation, this beautiful, beautiful nation, which, you know, is something that you really realize as you go over the trail, just how beautiful, but also how vast it is. So, you know, maybe in a larger sense, Marcus, maybe it was a success story, and maybe that's why we keep thinking about it.
Well, what about the aspect that I always heard that it was almost obsolete before it even began because of, you know, the telegraph?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It was never really intended by its owners to last very long. I mean, they were using it primarily as, I guess, what we would call today as a loss leader to get a big government contract and kind of set up and knit their business together. And they knew that the telegraph was, you know, the coming thing. As a matter of fact, they used the telegraph. They also used, where they could, railroads. So the telegraph, well, you know, I guess we could say that the telegraph made it obsolete. In a sense, they were kind of, you know, working along with it, you know, from the very start. And they didn't really intend, they thought it would last, the pony service would last a lot longer than it did, or they hoped so, but they didn't, they had no illusion that it would last for, you know, 10 years even.
Now, was it truly an unbroken chain of riders on ponies, or was it here's a stretch on horseback and then you get a little bit of help from a stagecoach? I'm wondering how fairly they did they pulled this off.
Well, as far as the pony, as far as letters carried by the pony itself, yes, it was an unbroken stretch. And amazingly, we have the records which indicate that Every delivery was made, and pretty much in the 10 days or so that they promised and predicted when they started. And the reason we know that is because some collectors over the years have collected the covers, basically, of, you know, from every ride, and they've done an amazing job. And I was very, very fortunate working on West Like Lightning to be allowed, you know, the use of some of their research, and also they very generously allowed me to print a picture or two in the book. And it's amazing the fact I think that there was one, if I'm remembering correctly, there was only one mail delivery that got lost in that whole period of time, and it actually turned up several months later. And you know, that's a pretty good record. You know, you look at the post office today, and God bless them, they do a great job. But I'm not sure that that their record is quite as good as the Pony Express's.
So, when you say that people collected covers, what kind of an artifact are you really talking about there?
We're talking about basically an envelope that would have been used for, and there's different ones, obviously, that would have been used to send a message in the day. As a general rule, a letter, let's say a regular letter that would be sent, would be written on very, very, very thin paper and posted from, you know, either St. Joe's or perhaps someplace along the way to go out to California and Sacramento, and then in other cases to go, you know, come back west. They had to be light because at least when the service started, I think it was a half ounce, which is kind of a, as you can imagine, a very light piece of paper, cost $5, and $5 then was real money. The price goes down as time goes on, but I believe that most of the correspondence were relatively small, very light messages.
So when you say 10 days, we're not talking coast to coast. I know that the whole enterprise began somewhere in Missouri, didn't it?
Well, actually, you could send something from the coast, and often they did. And the whole idea of the Pony Express really was to link up the country, link the East with the West. This was very important to the people in the West, because they had left their families, and they also, the East was where there was a lot of business. And the people in the East really wanted to connect with California because, well, you know, they'd found this gold stuff in the ground. So, and at the time, gold was where money came from directly. So they wanted to keep keep those lines of communication going. And you could actually send a letter from let's say New York City. It would go generally by rail out to Missouri, and it would go to St. Joe. And at St. Joe, it would be delivered to the Pony Express office there, and a rider would take off, and roughly 10 days later, it would show up in Sacramento.
Now, in your subtitle, you say it was a brief, legendary ride. Just how brief? How long did the venture last?
Well, the first ride was April 3rd, 1860, and the service ends in October 1861. I'm not sure I have enough fingers on my hand to count how many months that is.
About a year and a half, a little bit more.
It's about a year and a half. Towards the end there, they have a number of financial and legal problems. Those things are intertwined, and Wells Fargo ends up taking them over, and the service is, let's say, it dies a natural death.
So you said earlier that this was a loss leader for the entrepreneurial spirits behind it. The gentleman that made this go, last names Russell, Waddell, and Majors, did they just sell out?
Well, not exactly. Now, you know, these three guys, they kind of run the gamut of American American entrepreneurs, let's say, of that period, you have Alexander Majors, who's really kind of the hands-on guy. You think of him as kind of a teamster, but a teamster from those old days. And you know, he drove oxes, and he was a very religious man, but he was also very hardworking, and you know, would spend much, if not all, of his time out on the, you know, out on the trails and out on the range, so to speak. Total contrast to him was William Russell, who was, I would call him an entrepreneur, say. He was the guy who worked back east, even though he had been from the Midwest. He worked back east, setting up all the financing, dealing with bankers, dealing with whining and dining congressmen, trying to get the contract and then kind of get funding. And kind of in the middle of that was William Waddell, who was, his kind of a, unfortunately, we don't know a huge amount about him. He seems to have been kind of a quiet storekeeper type, although he also was pretty good with money and books, much to his distress, as the pony and the larger company around it started to experience huge financial problems.
Yeah. Now, if this was their lost leader, what was their mainstay supposed to be?
Well, what they did was deliver. Think of them as a freight delivery system that did everything from deliver letters, like the Pony Express, to delivering vast supplies to mostly to the government, because that was the army was there, and they were essentially aiming to to kind of corner the market on delivery services in the West. It sounds like kind of a odd idea, and yet, in a lot of ways, their model was another highly successful company that had done essentially the same thing a few decades earlier in upstate New York, and then what becomes the Midwest. And that company's still with us. We call it American Express. Some of the people behind American Express ended up being their fiercest competitors, Wells Fargo, which is also with us. And sometimes I think if the pony had survived, we would all be, maybe the card that we wouldn't leave home without would be the Pony Express card.
Well, this is really fascinating to think that we have descendants today of these corporate ventures. They're still around.
Absolutely. It's obviously delivering goods. I mean, we know, getting goods from place A to place B is very, very important. And even more so in those days, and certainly now, getting money from one point to another point was highly profitable. And that's where, obviously, where American Express and Wells Fargo end up. They're still with us today in that form.
Well, this is kind of nuts and bolts stuff we've been talking about, but there's an overlay of mystique that eventually accrues to this whole thing, and it has to do with the mystique of the Wild West and Buffalo Bill and the stories of the writers themselves. We're going to get into all of that in just a moment here on Constant Wonder, as we're visiting with Jim DeFelice. We're talking about his book, West Like Lightning, The Brief Legendary Ride of the Pony Express. Back with more Constant Wonder in just a moment. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Jim DeFelice is with us, a New York Times bestselling author, and we're talking about the Pony Express. His book is titled West Like Lightning. Jim, there comes a point at which stories too good to be true, like young men on ponies delivering at lightning speed the mail across the country, those stories, they kind of spin into, they take on a life of their own, and who knows what people will claim. And I mentioned the word mystique. There's quite a legendary aspect to this. Does it kind of just go to the point of being almost unbelievable? Does it get spun too far?
Well, there's a couple of stories. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that attracts us to the Pony Express, and in a larger sense, a lot of stories about the Old West, you know, are those tales which kind of blend, you know, truth with fiction, and yet get underneath, you know, kind of the surface accoutrements, let's say, of the art or the or just the tale, and kind of speak to a, you know, kind of a deeper truth. We can't forget, and you know, I know where we're going here. So, but before we go there, let's mention that the riders, who rode on the trail. I mean, that's a pretty strenuous job. I mean, they're out there. If we kind of average it out, they're probably riding between 75 and 100 miles, you know, at a stretch, changing horses 4, 5, or 6 times. And, you know, it's very strenuous. They're riding in all sorts of weather at all times of, you know, of day. And so what they achieve really, you know, is a great, you know, achievement of, you know, just human endurance.
Yeah, they're like the first American Ninja Warriors.
Well, kind of. Absolutely. They're paid, I'll tell you one thing, they're paid really well. They were, or at least to start, they were paid about $100, not about, they were paid $100 a month. And, you know, you're 18, well, 19, 20, 21, that's a lot of, well, that's a lot of money then, no matter what age you were, but that was a pretty good salary at the time.
And the youngest of all, I understand, was about 11?
I don't know about
that. Is that a stretch?
We have to mention the most famous rider of all, who, you know, without a doubt, if anybody knows about the Pony Express and the riders, they're going to mention the most famous rider, who is Buffalo Bill. And I have to say, Bill Cody did not ride, as far as, in my opinion. Cody was very famous and did more for the Pony Express, pretty much, or at least the legend, than anyone else. But he did not, almost surely did not ride for the service.
Really?
He said he did.
Oh, I'm just all deflated now.
Well, you can believe it if you want. And you know, the thing is, there's never, you can't prove a negative, and he certainly said that he rode. I'll tell you what he did do, though, and there's no real question about it. He put on these phenomenal shows that were a great hit, not only across America, and in all the big cities and in a lot of small towns, but also in Europe. And he put on the Wild West shows, and they were kind of like the Super Bowl of their day, except they would come to your town, which was phenomenal, and you know, you'd spend several days there, and everybody would have a vacation and go back and back and back. And always in those shows, there would be at least one vignette, often beginning, sometimes ending, sometimes both, of the Pony Express. And it's largely because of the popularity of those shows that we, you know, there was this groundswell of memories and stories and fascination with the Pony Express. And that's kind of lasted with us till today.
Do you suppose in those Wild West shows that the main hazards, I mean, it can only be so interesting to watch a pony dart from one part of the stage to the other. You got to have some, you know, there's got to be a complication of the plot, right?
Oh, there's lots of complications in the plot. Now, in real life, there were not too many people would be watching the pony riders at, you know, 3 a.m. in the morning. Although I have to say that, at least by reputation, the pony riders rode a little bit faster, a little bit prouder, if there was a pretty girl around. But, you know, for the stage, you know, maybe you need some shooting, some possible enemies, some bandits, some Native Americans, and you know, a little bit of gunplay never hurt. So they were always very entertaining. And the horses, as far as we know, no horse was hurt in any of the production.
So it was kind of like a roving theme park, this whole show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you can take those in all kinds of directions just for, you know, for excitement. There was excitement enough in the real history of what these people pulled off, and I think that's the point you were making earlier, that we got to give these guys credit for what they did. Would you kind of describe just the mechanics of I'm going to call it the baton toss, you know, where if it's a relay, how does that all work?
Sure. Well, what you would do, as the rider would set out from kind of a home station and would ride to a transfer spot. And this varied, and we're talking, obviously, you know, over 1,900 miles, so there's, depending on where exactly we're talking, it could actually be a could even be a saloon or a barn. Often it was, if we're way out in the desert, it was just kind of maybe a lean-to. And standing there, waiting there, would usually be a young boy, maybe 11 years old, and he would have a horse, and the rider would come up, as he approached, get off the horse, take his saddlebag, and the maquila, which was a special kind of bag that carried the Pony Express letters, and throw it on the new horse, and you know, and jump on and ride off, go another 10 miles or so, and this would be repeated four or five. It depends where we're talking, but four or five. Maybe six times before he arrived at another home station, and there a fresh rider would take over. Now at that point, the rider would could have been riding for, you know, 10 hours more or less, and probably would be very sore. He'd want to get something to eat, and he might you know, catch a nap, which, depending on where he was, it might be an attic of a small house or inn, or might be the straw of a, you know, of a barn. And he would wait until, as a general rule, depending on where he lived, but as a general rule, he would wait until a rider approached from the other direction, and then he would ride back, kind of repeat the process in reverse, and you know, until he got to the home station. They would be making, I guess, roughly four trips a week, you know, back and forth.
Yeah, it sounds to me like each of them had they were responsible for a certain leg of the trip, and they probably got to know that leg very well.
Absolutely, and wherever they could, the riders were hired from, as a general rule, from that area. So they knew the terrain, they knew the shortcuts, they knew, most importantly, they knew the places to avoid, which was probably just as important. I mean, especially when you're riding in the dark, you don't want to be falling off a cliff.
Now, sometimes I've heard it kind of said that there had to be a certain physique. You couldn't be a big, hefty guy to do this, and it's kind of like jockeys today. But there were some exceptions, I understand.
There were. As a general rule, they were not necessarily – well, everybody, I guess, at that age in those days was probably a little physically smaller than we are today because of, you know, diets and whatnot. But, yeah, as a general rule, they were on the slimmer but athletic, wiry, I guess we would call them, wiry.
A 6 foot tall fellow, though, I understand, was in the mix too, and that's, I don't know how he passed. You turn in your resume, and you have to lie about it, I guess.
No, I. they did try to hire the best riders from the area. So
yeah.
There was no height requirement one way or the other.
Now, just in conclusion here, and you've said it had a short life, it was subsumed in other modes of transportation and conveyance. But has it ever crossed your mind that in the whole sweep of human history, there have been endless attempts to get messages from here to there in different ways. I'm thinking, for example, of the ancient Roman fortifications, the limes through Europe, and the towers, and sometimes signals by, I don't know, light or what have you, fires to span a continent. This is a grand and venerable tradition to try to do what's humanly impossible.
Absolutely. You know, that's a really good point. You know, in some ways, I suppose we, you know, we still do that with, you know, whether we've gone from, you know, now we use email and text messages to send information, and I don't know what the next wave of, you know, passing along information will be, but whatever it is, we will certainly adopt it quickly. I mean, information is, you know, is vital to, certainly vital to us now, but also, as you say, you know, to the Romans and really to every civilization. And that's probably another reason, Marcus, that, you know, besides the, yeah, you know, besides the romance and all the cool stories that are associated with the Pony Express, that we keep coming back to it, because it was the fastest way to get information, you know, across the country before the telegraph came into full operation.
Well, Jim DeFelice, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Great. It was. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Jim DeFelice, a New York Times bestselling author. We've been talking with him about the Pony Express. His book is titled West Like Lightning, The Brief Legendary Ride of the Pony Express.
Constant Wonder will be right back with a story about one of the weirdest art installations anywhere. It's a man-made jetty in the Great Salt Lake, constructed in the shape of a spiral. Constant Wonder will be right back. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Sam Payne is now back with us from the storytelling show The Appleseed on BYU Radio, featuring storytellers from around the world, all sorts of stories. If you haven't heard the show, you really need to tune in sometime. It's going to be funny, adventurous, heartwarming. I think he makes room for a little tragedy now and then, but it's always human, great storytelling. New episodes Monday through Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific time. Sam Payne, welcome back to our program.
It's such a pleasure to be with you. You know, it's such a pleasure to hear people talk about the Pony Express, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, having just heard a little bit about it, it never made sense to me when I was a kid. You need horses, not ponies. Horses are bigger, you know?
Those guys were just incredible. Those Pony Express boys were just incredible. It comes from that the story of the Pony Express comes from such an interesting time, you know, and you never know what is gonna spark a memory for you, and you never know what memory it's gonna spark. And hearing about the Pony Express and thinking about the Pony Express sparks thoughts for me of what came after, right? The Pony Express followed, you know, right on the heels of the Pony Express comes the completion of the first transcontinental telegraph, and then right on the heels of the completion of the first transcontinental telegraph comes the 7-year push toward the completion of the first transcontinental railroad. And I'm thinking sort of down that line of these things that are sort of, you know, crossing frontiers like the Pony Express did, and like the telegraph did, and like the first transcontinental railroad did. And it takes me to a kind of a family memory, and in this memory we're driving out to, well, we drove and drove and drove and drove and drove out to the edge of the Great Salt Lake in Utah one early spring to see this big art installation out there called the Spiral Jetty. Right?
You didn't go there, did you?
We went to see the Spiral Jetty. It is, I must say, I didn't learn this until later, the official work of land art of the state of Utah.
Now, I just have to test you. I've got to test you to know that this is legit. You actually went there, because this is in a remote location.
It really is.
Yeah. Does it spiral clockwise towards the center or counterclockwise? And put me on the spot.
It goes out. It goes out away from the shore, and then takes a hard left. So it's gonna go. It's gonna go counterclockwise.
You pass the test.
That's right. I mean, it's this enormous spiral of stones created under the direction of an artist named Robert Smithson. And as you said, you know, how do you get there? I mean, you drive and drive and drive and drive and drive until you think you're lost. And once that happens, you're getting close. You know,
just feels like you've been going in circles here. There, you know?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's a Spiral Jetty joke. I get that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that the story of the Spiral Jetty, that's quite a story, by the way. Smithson had crews of backhoes and loaders moving rocks for 6 days to install that thing. And then he sat back and looked at it for a few days and didn't quite like it. And so brought the crews all back for another 3 days to reconfigure the whole thing. And the guy in charge of the loading of rocks would say later on in his life that it seemed unusual to him that the job for which he'd be best remembered was, the way he put it, a job that wasn't for anything. And, you know, we went out there and we had somehow forgotten that the road to the Spiral Jetty goes past the site where the rails met at the completion of the first Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. And there it was. There was that site. You can't get to the Spiral Jetty without passing it. And we thought, let's go there too. And we went to the visitor center there and we saw this unusual exhibit there. And in this exhibit was a golden spike mounted behind glass. And at first, we wondered if it was the actual golden spike. I mean, what did we know? You know, one of the four spikes made of precious metals driven to join the rails between east and west. Those spikes were, you know, dropped into the holes made for them and then immediately taken back out and spirited off to museums, you know. But this spike wasn't that spike at all. That spike lives elsewhere, off in California. This spike was a replica spike made to fly on the space shuttle Atlantis. And there in the visitor center, above that replica spike is a sign. And the sign says the following. It says, "This replica of the original golden spike was part of the official flight kit aboard Orbiter Atlantis during space shuttle mission STD-38, November 15 to 20, 1990. By this gesture, the ribbons of iron that spanned America's first frontier are united with the ribbons of fire that are spanning America's final frontier." That's what the sign says. And, you know, the hair on the back of my neck stands up. I come over in, you know, in goose flesh, you know. I'm kind of a fan of space exploration. And it caught my imagination that these guys who are now flying rovers to Mars, these guys who continue even now to monitor the silent travels of the Voyager spacecraft, so many millions and millions and miles away, they've found themselves inspired by things like the first transcontinental railroad, that there's this kind of DNA connection between the people who were doing that space exploration and the people who laid those rails and the people who strung the telegraph wires and the Pony Express guys. They consider themselves sort of part of the same frontier expanding family. You know, I mean, if you look into the story of every one of those 19th century ventures, right, from the Pony Express to the telegraph to the railroad, you find the worst of us, right, when it comes to human relations and dealing with the land and its people, right? At our best, we disregarded people who were unlike us as somehow subhuman and not worthy of the treatment we'd extend to people who we perceived as like us. Those stories are filled with skullduggery and greed and oppression, and there is absolutely no denying that. But this notion of crossing frontiers, it kind of still inspires us. Those Pony Express boys inspiring the completion of the telegraph and then instantly made obsolete by it, right? And then along would come the railroad too, these logistics and engineering marvels, these expressions of, well, being inspired by those stories that came before us. It's really remarkable to think about, you know, the way that we continue to be inspired in some of the work that we do as human beings now by some of those short-lived little ventures like the Pony Express.
It really is a remarkable genealogy, I would think, that goes back. And if you push it to its limits, you can go back to prehistory and just wonder about the distances that people covered and how they did that. And were there, you know, batons to pass from hand to hand with messages in them, that sort of thing, you know? And I guess right. if you go far enough, it's turtles all the way down.
Yeah. Yeah. I go back to the comment of the guy who said, you know, the rock moving job that I will be most remembered for is one that's not for anything, you know? And when I think about that, I say, yeah, not for anything except to kind of, turn our eyes from the ground to the sky, you know? I mean, turn to things that are for that wind up kind of inspiring us in an odd way. Weirdly, it takes me to memories of 1977, sitting in a movie theater and seeing the original Star Wars film for the first time, you know, the opening shot of Star Wars with this enormous spaceship flying.
Oh, over, yes.
You know? And you hear people all the time tracing their careers as scientists or movie makers or whatever to that shot, you know, to just kind of having their minds blown by that shot, you know. What kinds of things do we get ourselves up to after having our minds blown by thoughts of these boys just riding hell-bent for leather across mountain and plain on these ponies, you know?
You've made me think about the fact that if you're out there in the western deserts of the United States, the eye can be drawn from horizon to horizon very easily. And if you're out near Promontory, Utah, and you're thinking about the Transcontinental Railroad, you're thinking about the extensive horizontal reach of that thing. And yet for you to see that spike and read about the shuttle, suddenly that puts your eyes in a different direction. You're looking vertically, and the West has a lot of sky over it too. That's kind of a humbling thing to consider.
And to think about those guys who are putting those things in orbit, those astronauts who are flying around the world with thoughts in their heads of some of those 19th century adventures. It's quite a thing.
Well, I'll make it out to the Spiral Jetty, and I'll think of you, Sam, next time I'm out there, I'm sure. I'll be in the car, in the van with the kids, and they're going to say, are we there yet? Are we there yet? And I'll say, it's just around the next bend, just the next bend.
That's right, and you'll have to say, when we get there, remember to fix in your mind the direction that the spiral turns, because Sam will ask you.
He will. I hope you will. Sam, a pleasure always to be with you. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Sam Payne, host of The Appleseed, which airs Monday through Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific time on BYU Radio.
And that was Marcus Smith there speaking with Sam Payne. I'm Tenery Taylor. We're going to finish off the hour now with a tribute to some close kin of the kinds of people who rode across the American West carrying the mail. Maybe reckless, definitely fearless. It's the same spirit of risk-taking and surmounting the seemingly insurmountable that drives mountaineers. To learn more about that intrepid spirit, Marcus spoke not long ago with Scott Ellsworth, the author of The World Beneath Their Feet, Mountaineering Madness and the Deadly Race to Summit the Himalayas. Here's a piece of that conversation.
What I discovered when I started digging into the story is there's just this incredible saga that happens during those three decades in between, particularly during the 1930s. You know, climbers today, the climbers that queue up on Mount Everest, and we've seen these photographs, their equipment is just absolutely top flight, is, you know, state-of-the-art equipment. $1,000 insulated silicone boots, carbon steel ice axes. They can get real-time satellite weather forecasts on their phones. You know, all of this clothing made out of this, you know, nanotechnology, all this terrific gear. Well, back in the 1930s, the climbers had leather boots, they had wooden ice axes, they had canvas parkas, they didn't really have any decent maps or photographs, they didn't exactly know where they were going or what route they were going to take because nobody had been on top of these incredibly dangerous peaks before. These mountains are so large, these 8,000ers, as they call them in the Himalayas, that they can make their own weather. You have avalanches where chunks of ice and snow as big as an automobile or as big as a two-story house is going to start falling down. These mountains are twice as high as the Andes or the Alps or the Rockies, and they're just, you know, hurricane force winds. And what's astonishing is how far that these climbers got. I mean, they got within 1,000 feet to the top of Everest. They got quite high on a number of these mountains as well. But along the way, they also did things that nobody had ever seen. I tell the story of this British effort on Nanda Devi, this incredible peak, a little shy of 8,000 meters. But it was surrounded by this ring of seemingly impenetrable mountains, 15,000 feet high. And in between this ring and the peak itself was something called the sanctuary, which is this lush green world that no human being had ever been into before. And a very small British expedition was able to do that. The animals would just come up to these climbers and Sherpas. There were 2 Brits and 3 Sherpas, and regard them because they had no fear of humans because they had never contacted any contact with humans before. So they're really, you know, pushing into these lands that were, you know, that was the inspiration for James Hilton and Shangri-La from the novel and movie Lost Horizon. That was all taken from the pages of the London Times and newsreels and other things about what these incredibly daring and resourceful climbers were doing.
Well, if they didn't have equipment that was high tech in those days, and I can't even imagine that, at least they had backing. There were a lot of people putting up a lot of money to make this happen.
Well, they did have backing, but here's the funny thing. So I'd mentioned the British and the Germans. They had these large expeditions, you know, that were well-funded, at least initially, with all of these Sherpas and whatnot. But here comes the Americans. So climbing in the United States up until, you know, roughly the 1930s, there were 2 centers. One was in the West, but the other was in the Northeast amongst the Ivy League schools and Ivy League climbing clubs. And so these Americans who were in these schools, Ivy League schools, they're trying to mimic the British and do what the British do and follow their ways. But what happens once the American climbers from the Northeast start to go west, first to the Rockies, then the Canadian Rockies and Alaska, and having these larger expeditions, they discovered the fact that they couldn't hire any native people to, you know, to carry their material with them. The people simply weren't there, and they had no interest in doing this. So what happens is that the American climbing style becomes one of self-reliance. Instead of huge expeditions, we're going to have really small expeditions. Just a handful of climbers who, as best as they can, are going to live off the land. They're going to go ahead and carry their own equipment up the sides of this mountain. The first great American climbing achievement in the greater Himalayas, this happened in China, was at a mountain called Minnetonka that was once thought to be taller than Everest. It wasn't. But there were exactly 4 American climbers. They could all fit into a New York City taxi cab who managed to get from New York City, you know, on a steamship to Shanghai. They enter Shanghai as the Japanese Navy is shelling Shanghai. Half their equipment is stolen. They work their way to this remote corner of southwestern China, and they managed to pull off this incredible feat. It was the second highest mountain ever climbed at that point.
This is sounding very much like a, how shall I say this? It's reminding me of the Jamaican bobsled team, frankly.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's exactly what it is. And the Americans were forced by necessity to be, you know, to use ingenuity and to try different ways of doing things. And I tell the story of this incredible group of Americans, including an amazing man by the name of Jack Young, who was essentially the first Asian-American mountaineer ever. He was a renowned hunter. He had helped the Roosevelt brothers, you know, on an expedition to China before that. And he was able to kind of bridge the world between the Chinese and the Americans. But, you know, along the way, they have a horse stolen by bandit Chinese soldiers. So Jack Young and his partner, they just go and steal it back. I mean, they find ways. I mean, what they're doing is just remarkable in terms of, you know, countryside that Westerners had never been to before, and they are pulling off these feats like nobody else ever had.
Would you address a little bit the idea that it seems that Germany and Great Britain, the Americans, eventually they kind of put down their stakes on different mountains?
They did. So Mount Everest is on the border between Nepal and Tibet. And Nepal was a closed country, you know, until after World War II. You couldn't get there. But the British had enough influence in Tibet to be allowed to enter Tibet to climb up the Tibetan side or attempt to climb up the side, Tibetan side of Mount Everest. And they were able to keep others out. Well, the Germans, meanwhile, they first tried a mountain called Kanchenjunga. That didn't work out. And then they tried this mountain called Naga Parbat. But what happened is in 1934, they had a horrible tragedy there. A number of climbers were killed there, and Sherpas died as well, too, one of the worst mountaineering accidents. And once that happened, then it became the Germans were sort of stuck with Naga Parbat. They weren't interested in any other mountain. That was going to be the 8,000er that they had to climb. And then 3 years later, in 1937, they lost other climbers in an avalanche. So they're in this sort of death embrace with Naga Parbat. This is their mountain, very, very difficult mountain, a mountain that was not climbed until Mount Everest was climbed. And that became involved with national pride. And at this point, of course, the Nazis have taken over. So, you know, now the climbers have to be Nazi party members as well, too. The Americans, meanwhile, they go looking for their own mountain. We want to try to find one that hadn't been climbed. And they ended up embracing K2, the second highest mountain on Earth, and in a mountain that was, in fact, much, much more difficult to climb than Mount Everest.
Now, this is really interesting to me because it seems like by settling on one mountain or the other, it was previous failures that kind of solidified their determination to succeed on that mountain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It became a matter of national pride to climb that. Once they had committed to a peak, that was the one that they were going to stick with.
One of the strangest characters in your book is a fellow named Maurice Wilson.
Yeah.
And I just have to have you describe him and what he attempted to do.
Well, Wilson was this, you know, he was a Brit. He was a World War One vet. You know, he fought, you know, like in the movie 1917 on the Western Front. He was a decorated hero. But like many, you know, World War One soldiers who endured this hell in the trenches, you know, he came back and he didn't know what to do with himself. He tried this and that. He immigrated to New York City, then to San Francisco. He ends up in New Zealand running a women's clothing store, decides to come back to Britain, and he becomes interested in Eastern ways of thought and yogis and certainly in Indian religion. He gets sick in England, in London. He meets a man who said that he had cured himself by fasting for 30 days and all of this. And Wilson tries this and decides that this sort of new regimen is going to be the thing that will give people power. And he decides he wants to demonstrate this by to show what you can do if you treat yourself correctly and eat the right foods and all this stuff, that he was going to go ahead and climb Mount Everest all alone. And so his plan was he was going to fly an airplane and crash it, you know, on the slopes of Mount Everest or crash land it and then just finish the rest off by himself. The problem was he didn't know anything about mountain climbing or mountaineering. He didn't know anything about flying either, but he bought an airplane. He then took some flying lessons, enough to sort of barely be able to manage the plane. He took he went to a couple of mountaineering shops. He talked to a couple of people, learned some of the basics. And meanwhile, the British government has heard about this crazy person who intends to do all this. They try to keep him from, you know, taking off and leaving, but he goes off anyway. And he flies, you know, 5,000 miles, you know, basically by sight. There aren't, radio beacons in those days to guide pilots. He didn't really know much about flying, but makes his way through all sorts of subterfuge and sheer luck and guts all the way to India, lands his plane there. The British authorities are going to deny that he's going to be able to get his plane anywhere close to Nepal. And so he goes and lives in this border hill town called Darjeeling. And then one night he sneaks out with three Sherpas, and they are going to take off to climb Mount Everest.
You know, a fool is born every moment, I suppose. But this is a precursor to Eddie the Eagle, if anybody remembers him on the ski jumps.
Absolutely. And the funny thing, and he goes, and they then make a 300-mile trek to Mount Everest, and he gets to Everest, and the Sherpas help him a little, but then he's on his own. He tries to get up a certain part of the mountain, couldn't do it, tries again, and they, at a certain point, refuse to help him, and he goes on. And of course, he ends up dying in the attempt. But 1 or 2 years later, a group of British, you know, trained British mountaineers, they found his body. And the funny thing is they didn't consider him to be crazy. They understood the need to try and do something like this. They were sad that he, you know, he was poorly equipped, had no idea. But they, you know, inter his body in a crevasse. They read his diary. And the diary still exists. I saw it in London at the Alpine Club archives. But the funny thing is that I think is probably the greatest elegy to Wilson was said by a British climber by the name of Frank Smythe. And he said, it wasn't mountaineering, but it was magnificent.
Hmm. Scott Ellsworth, I think I'd like to tie a bow on our conversation today by going back to famous words spoken by George Mallory. He is known for having been asked why, you know, that big question, why would you even do this? And I guess it started with him when he's the guy who said, because it's there. Does that work for you?
Well, I think it you know, I think it's part of human nature, you know. You know, I closed the book with, of all people, John F. Kennedy, who had spent time in Europe while all these expeditions are going on. And when he announced the American, you know, space program to land a man on the moon, he went back and talked about Mallory and because it's there. And, you know, and he said, and space is there, and we're going to climb it as well. I think it's a natural part of human beings, not for most human beings, but it's a part of humans in general to want to go higher, to want to go further, you know, to want to, you know, explore these last frontiers. You know, certainly the tops of the Himalayas were the last sort of landmass for human beings to get to, you know, and now we've turned ourselves to space, and it sounds like to Mars is going to be next.
You see a direct connection between the ambitions of the mountaineers and the current ambitions to go to a place like Mars.
Absolutely. I think it's part of our DNA.
Marcus Smith there speaking with Scott Ellsworth, the author of The World Beneath Their Feet, Mountaineering Madness and the Deadly Race to Summit the Himalayas. I'm Tenery Taylor, and speaking of people who are willing to surmount the insurmountable, when Constant Wonder returns from a short break, we'll visit the curator of the Disgusting Food Museum in Sweden, where your entrance ticket comes in the form of a vomit bag. I'm not kidding. Constant Wonder will be right back after the news.